Welcome. You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Hello and welcome to the Black Experience Hour. This is a weekly program. This is being recorded for the listening week that begins March 29th. Your reader's name is Susan Shirey. This week's sources include, among others, the New York Times, thegriot.com, theroot.com. I'll open with some sports articles. This first one from the New York Times. A forgotten championship HBCU team comes off the sidelines. Surviving members of the all-black Tennessee A&I basketball team have fought for recognition since they won three back-to-back national championships at the height of the Jim Crow era. This is written by Remy Tumin, and it was published originally February 3rd. In 1957, the men's basketball program at Tennessee Agricultural and Industrial State University in Nashville had all the makings of a great team, a coach dedicated to the fundamentals of the game and a fast-breaking offense that applied relentless full-court pressure. Quote, "We felt that if we stayed focused, there was nobody else who could beat us," end quote, said Dick Barnett, a shooting guard for the team. That was true three times over. The Tennessee A&I Tigers, playing in the NAIA, would become the first team from an historically black college or university to win any national championship, and the first college team to win three back-to-back championships. But the team, caught in the headwinds of the Jim Crow South, has struggled for recognition ever since. Barnett, now 87, who went on to play for the two New York Knicks championship teams in the 1970s, has spent the last decade working to correct that. He has spent years campaigning for the Tigers to be inducted into the Naismith Memorial Basketball Hall of Fame, and is teaching a new generation of basketball players at Tennessee State University, as the school is now known, about the barrier-breaking team. His journey is now the subject of a new PBS documentary titled The Dream Whisperer. And if Barnett has his way, the journey will include one final stop, the White House. More than 50 members of Congress have signed a letter on the team's behalf asking for an invitation, quote, "for long overdue acknowledgement and proper celebration," end quote. Time is of the essence. Only seven players from the championship teams are still alive, and only three of them and a surviving assistant coach are healthy enough to travel, said Danielle Nasana, a producer of the film, quote, "I still feel like it's a big issue, not just for me, but for my race, to be accepted and to go to the White House after being omitted all of those years," end quote. George Finley, 85, a former center for the team, said in an interview. The White House did not respond to a request for a comment. If the team gets there, it will be because of Barnett. And there is, I'll just interject, there's a picture here included of Barnett holding a tiny basketball, sort of a toy basketball. And the caption says, "Barnett has spent years advocating for broader recognition of his team and its achievements. Their biggest hurdle," he said, "was," quote, "skin color, skin color, skin color." Back to the article. Barnett grew up in segregated Gary, Indiana, shooting ping pong balls into a tin cup. But when he was around 9 or 10 years old, he traded them for a basketball and would shoot at a local court late into the night. On one of those nights, he was practicing his signature jump shot, which was a question-marked shape shot with plenty of air, when the Tigers' coach, John McClendon, showed up asking if he'd like to join him at Tennessee A&I. Barnett arrived in Nashville in 1955, the year Emmett Till was murdered in Mississippi, and Rosa Parks was arrested in Montgomery, Alabama, for refusing to give up her seat to a white man on a city bus. The team was keenly aware of the societal forces working against them, said Barnett. Their biggest hurdle could be summed up in two words, he said, quote, skin color, skin color, skin color. He went on, quote, the implication was that if you were not good enough as white folks to do what we wanted to do, that this is America. This is a white American society. We were a part of American history, even though we were a different color, a different style, end quote. Pardon me, I think I misquoted that. I'm going to reread that. The quote is, the implication was that you were not good enough as white folks to do what we wanted to do. That this is America, this is a white American society. We were a part of American history, even though we were a different color, a different style, end quote. Barnett said McClendon put in tremendous effort to keep his players focused and understand that, quote, we were just as good as anybody else playing this game, end quote. Even if it meant staying in private homes when playing on the road because hotels would not host them, Barnett said, quote, I always knew I was great. I was a great shooter. I was a great player. McClendon, a disciple of basketball's inventor, James Naismith, was fighting his own battle. He had tried to move Tennessee A&I to the NCAA, but was denied entry. So instead, the team played in the National Association of Intercollegiate Athletics. The Tigers, conditioned for speed and accuracy, jolted the league by winning championships in 1957, 58, and 59. Nine players from the Tennessee A&I championship teams would go on to play professional basketball. The championship wins are noted on pendants that hang from the rafters at the Gentry Center at Tennessee State. But the team's legacy was all but lost to history, until Barnett, quote, decided to do something about it, as he says in the documentary. In the film, the former NBA players Julius Erving, Walt Frazier, Bill Bradley, and Phil Jackson all make the case for the team's induction into the Basketball Hall of Fame, but it took Barnett nearly a decade to make the case to Hall of Fame voters that his team was worthy of recognition. In 2019, he finally slipped on the orange jacket at the induction ceremony as a representative of the team. Quote, his leadership on the floor as a basketball player was really the type of show me, don't tell me. That was the same way it was with making the film, end quote, said Eric Drath, who directed the documentary. Ron Thomas, the author of, quote, They Cleared the Lane, colon, the NBA's Black Pioneers, end quote, said it was common in the Jim Crow era for black teams to be ignored by the white media. Thomas said, quote, America has missed out by not being able to hear about and read about and see the teams of some of these great coaches and players of that era. They got no exposure whatsoever, end quote, said Thomas, the director of the Journalism in Sports, Culture, and Social Justice program at Morehouse College. But for teams like the Tennessee A&I Tigers, there was an extra layer of responsibility, said Thomas, quote, they represent more than just themselves. This next sports article comes from NBC News, and it was posted March 20th originally, written by Sam Brock. Tennis phenom Coco Gauff strives for a medal and a second Grand Slam title while giving back to her community. Gauff told NBC News, quote, I want to pour into the communities that poured into me. And the author actually was Sam Brooke and, pardon me, Sam Brock and Carmen Gonzalez. Dateline Delray Beach, Florida. Coco Gauff's rise to the top of the tennis world has been both swift and electric. Only a few months ago, she captured her first Grand Slam title and the hearts and minds of the riveted crowd at Arthur Ashe Stadium in New York when she won the 2023 U.S. Open. Days ago, and fresh off her 20th birthday, Coco became the first American tennis player to mathematically clinch a spot on the Paris 2024 Olympic team. But on a windy, sun-splashed day, she's returned to her roots. Pardon me, she's returning to her roots in Delray Beach, a small city on Florida's southeast coast known for its lively downtown, colorful homes, and sweeping beaches, and as the locale of Gauff's turning into a tennis sensation. I want to pour into the communities that poured into me, quote, did Gauff, pardon me, Gauff told NBC News. She went on, quote, tennis is something I always will promote, but I want to promote sports and other extracurricular activities in general because I think everybody needs an outlet in their life, end quote. Back home with a purpose. Gauff is doing more than just that on this trip home, where she's teaming up with the U.S. Tennis Association as part of its U.S. Open Legacy Initiative to make tennis courts more inviting and accessible to young players all over the country. The courts she once played on with her father, parentheses, every morning at 8, at Pompey Park, are newly refurbished and the first project in a $3 million grant program. The USTA launched its Legacy Initiative in recognition of Gauff's women's singles title and matched the $3 million purse she earned, but it also builds off millions it has already awarded since 2005, affecting more than 43,000 tennis courts nationwide. Gauff said, quote, "The more access you allow children to get to these courts, and the more children that are playing, is the greater the probability of the next great champion coming along," end quote. For Gauff, it's also a reminder of where she came from. Etched into one of her New Balance tennis shoes are the geographic coordinates of Pompey Park. The other bears a quote from her father, quote, "You can change the world with your racket." Her family has certainly changed the world in many meaningful ways already. Right next to the tennis courts at the park sits a baseball field dedicated to Gauff's grandparents, Yvonne and Eddie Odom, who were civil rights trailblazers in Delray. Eddie created a little league for black children in 1970 and integrated the city's league shortly after. A decade before, in 1961, Gauff's grandmother, Yvonne Odom, became the first black student to attend what is now Atlantic Community High School in Delray, breaking through the color barrier there. Said Candy Gauff, Coco's mother, quote, "She was 15 years old at the time, and as I hear my mom tell the story, they sat on a panel and they needed to pick a student that could handle being in an all-white school and not react in a temperamental way. And then my grandfather volunteered my mom," end quote. "Without my family, I'm nothing." Given the momentous history, it makes sense that her family's past is so important to Coco and woven into every aspect of her present. Gauff said, quote, "For me, it means everything because without my family, I'm nothing," end quote. Her intense competitiveness and jaw-dropping talent continue to draw fans from around the globe and jumpstart a new chapter for the sport. Gauff said her to-do list for 2024 is actually pretty simple. Quote, "I want to win a Grand Slam and an Olympic medal. I particularly want to do it this year and win a medal. That's one of my dreams that I wanted to do as a tennis player," end quote. She says she'll compete in the singles and doubles events in Paris, with any potential selection for mixed doubles coming as a team decision, but which she'd be thrilled about doing as well. Goff was scheduled to make her Olympics debut in Tokyo, but tested positive for COVID-19 right before and had to withdraw. She said, quote, I was crushed for a day, and then I was like, well, there's nothing I can do about it. You know, people have lost family members, and I realized that life isn't about playing tennis, so I was okay with it after a day, end quote. As for her inspiration for playing tennis in the first place, quote, Serena and Venus, she said with a laugh, and then my dad, of course, he's the one who brought me my first racket, end quote. Goff saw the elder Williams sister play at the U.S. Open when she was only 8 years old. She said, I saw myself in Serena and Venus, and so it made me believe that I could do something too. Goff's father, Corey, who coached Coco from a young age and spent all those days on the court with his daughter training, credits the Williams sisters for giving so many families a powerful feeling, belief. He said, quote, I think a gap was missing between Arthur Ashe and the Williams sisters, but they let you know what's possible, and that's the biggest gift they could give you, and hopefully Coco does the same gift to any other parent. Let them know what is possible. Back to the New York Times for the next article. Overlooked no more, colon, Henry Hurd, tap dancer and advocate for people with disabilities. With one arm and one leg, he upended assumptions that disabled people could not lead fulfilling lives, and his artistry had audiences clamoring for more. This was originally posted in February also, February 2nd, written by Maisha Rosenberg. And there's a note at the top of the article. This article is part of Overlooked, a series of obituaries about remarkable people whose deaths, beginning in 1851, went unreported in the Times. It is October 1958, and the tap dancer Henry Hurd has taken the stage at the Copa Club in Columbus, Ohio, as part of a tour by the Idlewild Review, which hails from a resort town for African Americans in northwest Michigan. A slender, elegant man with one arm and one leg, he begins his performance by dancing with a crutch. Less than a minute in, he throws the crutch off stage and continues to dance, to thunderous applause. In the 1940s and 50s, Hurd was a popular act in the United States and Canada. He danced in the 1948 film Boarding House Blues and on the 1950s television variety show You Asked for It, gaining celebrity in the black press at a time when Hollywood, television, and rock and roll provided limited opportunities to black entertainers. His dancing upended audiences' assumptions that people with disabilities were incapable of leading fulfilling lives, and he boldly turned a derogatory term, crip, into a stage name, declaring pride in his body's unique power of expression. Parentheses, the term crip has more recently been reclaimed by some in the disability movement to express pride in their identities. Hurd's advocacy for people with disabilities didn't stop there. For years, he volunteered with agencies that supported them. He was known to say, "One of my main missions in life is to convince people not to give up." Henry Mack Hurd was born on November 10, 1924, in Memphis to Lucille Pollard and Robert Hurd, a cement finisher. Henry always loved music and was inspired by the dancer Bill Bojangles Robinson, as he told Ebony magazine when it profiled him in 1951. He learned to dance at age 6 and was performing in clubs by the time he was 14. On January 7, 1939, the car he was riding in with his group, the Three Dots, was struck by a train at an unguarded crossing in Memphis. Everyone in the car was killed except Henry, who suffered devastating injuries that necessitated the amputation of his right arm and right leg. After multiple surgeries, he thought his life as a dancer was over and he was tempted to give up. But he resolved not to. Quote, "I'd seen the blind and the crippled standing on street corners with their tin cups and pencils, and decided that I wanted to do more with my life than be the object of public curiosity and pity," end quote, he told the Columbus Star in 1958. Heard credited Jip Sandman Roberts, a comedian and singer, with encouraging him to train to dance again. He initially danced with a woman before taking off as a solo act in nightclubs and in a revival of a variety tent show called Silas Green from New Orleans. While Heard found a place in variety shows that could seem like relics of vaudeville, his musicality evoked the styles of sophisticated tap dancers like Chuck Green, Bunny Briggs, and Baby Lawrence, individualists who played with the rhythmic surprises of bebop. His innovative dancing was on display in Boarding House Blues, which starred Moms Mabley as the owner of a cash-strapped boarding house. To raise money, the tenants hold a show, and Heard is the opening act. He starts by using his crutch as he dances a Charleston step, accompanied by Lucky Millinder, and his orchestra. He then slides his crutch off stage at the end of a turn and keeps on dancing, sculpting accents in the air with his free arm and punctuating a drum break with backward steps. Heard's tossing off his crutch was part of his theatricality, said Constance Vallis Hill, a professor emerita of dance and performance at Hampshire College in Massachusetts. She went on, quote, "He's definitely in control of the gaze. He's got the audience completely in his hand," end quote. She added, quote, "You look at his foot and the arm and the hip. You forget that there's no other arm or leg. You're just looking at the beauty of the instruments he's playing with. He's a full-body dancer," end quote. Heard appeared at the Apollo Theater in Harlem, Club Alabama in Los Angeles, the Howard in Washington, D.C., and Club Delisa in Chicago, variously sharing bills with Della Reese, Louis Jordan, and T-Bone Walker. When Club Juana in Detroit wanted to bring in top bands, it hired Heard as the MC for jazz luminaries like Cab Calloway, Count Basie, and Dizzy Gillespie. He sometimes sang, once performing a duet with the blues performer Gladys Bentley. Wherever he traveled, Heard entertained patients at hospitals, including veterans' hospitals, refuting the prevalent attitude that people with disabilities were charity cases to be pitied. He appeared at community events held by the NAACP, as well as at Democratic Party fundraisers, and he founded a long-running annual Christmas benefit for children at the Illinois School and Rehabilitation Center in Chicago, often using his own money for gifts and dinner and dressing as Santa. Heard was one of a number of African-American tap dancers like Peg Leg Bates, Big Time Crip, and Jesse James, whose artistry made percussive use of a mobility aid. Quote, "There was a place for people who were entertainers," end quote, Rosemarie Garland Thompson, emerita professor of English and bioethics at Emory University, and a leader in the field of disability studies, said in a phone interview. She added, quote, "They were able to have jobs when many people with disabilities were simply locked up and institutionalized," end quote. Audiences loved Heard's acrobatic mastery of balance, his speed, and the versatility of his dance steps, from Boogie Woogie to Mambo. Thomas DeFrance, a professor of dance and black studies at Northwestern University, said Heard excelled at the swivel step, a component of the Charleston, the Susie Q, and some of James Brown's moves. Professor DeFrance added by phone, quote, "Heard finds so much rhythmic variation in it. He gives us accents, cross rhythms and downbeats, and little side rhythms. We get all of this through him manipulating his weight and his foot, and the performance is wrapped up with his own cool. End quote. On the TV variety show You Asked For It, Heard peppered three rapid-fire numbers with pyrotechnics. Colon. In the first, he interspersed double-time steps with triplets and trenches. In the second, he finger-snapped his way through a joyous Roomba. For his finale, he tapped up and down stairs a la Bill Robinson. He eventually settled in Chicago, married, had children, and got divorced. He enjoyed tennis, swimming, and bike riding. In 1959, Heard was robbed on his way home from a nightclub, and in early 1960, he fell, suffering a fractured skull and shoulder as well as a damaged eardrum. The prominent Chicago Friends held a benefit for him. Work grew scarce. In later years, he worked as a ward clerk for the Chicago Department of Streets and Sanitation and volunteered for the Goodwill Charity, the Social and Rehabilitation Service, in Washington, and the Illinois Board of Rehabilitation. All the while, he criticized such organizations for, quote, taking advantage of the disabled by giving them demeaning jobs and paying them a pittance. Quote, they're all very polite and want me to volunteer my services, he told The Defender in 1971. He went on, but no one is interested in hiring me to work full-time with the people who need help. In fact, there just aren't any substantial programs moving in that direction. And the handicapped, as a result, continue to struggle for the few charity jobs they can get. End quote. He died at his home in Chicago on September 11, 1991. After a long illness, he was 66. Heard would likely be pleased that many cutting-edge artists today are redefining both dance and disability through inclusive choreography and design. As Garland Thomas, the Emory scholar, said, quote, his distinctive moves anticipated the work of Axis Dance Company, Kinetic Light, Abilities Dance Boston, and Crip Hop Nation, that's spelled with a K. Groups that produce performances by people with disabilities and improve access for audiences. Still reading from the New York Times, this one was posted March 5th, written by Mia Jackson. New initiative to protect Black history starts with Coltrane. The Philadelphia Row House, once owned by the jazz musician, will be restored through funds provided by the African American Cultural Heritage Action Fund and the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation. The American jazz musician John Coltrane bought a three-story brick row house in Philadelphia's Strawberry Mansion neighborhood in 1952, using it as his primary residence or a stopping point when on tour until he died in 1967. Quote, I remember playing the upright piano in the home, said Ravi Coltrane, 58, the son of Coltrane and his second wife Alice Coltrane, an acclaimed harpist. He went on, quote, my father wrote a lot of music on that piano in the early 1950s. He composed Naima on that piano and many of the pieces he recorded on the album Blue Train. The Row House was designated a National Historic Landmark in 1999, but in recent years the condition of the Row House has deteriorated and is currently in need of major repairs and restoration. On Tuesday, the African American Cultural Heritage Action Fund, a program of the National Trust for Historic Preservation, announced that the Row House will be the first site to receive financial support through a new initiative called the Descendants and Family Stewardship. The Action Fund will assist in coordinating and financing the transfer of Coltrane's home from its current owner back to his family. The extended Coltrane family has strong ties to the Row House, colon, Coltrane's mother, first cousin, childhood friend, and eventually Juanita Grubbs, his first wife, who also was known as Naima, lived with him when he first bought it, and his mother and cousin lived there permanently. After Coltrane's death in 1967, the home remained in the family for many years. His cousin, Mary Alexander, owned the house until 2004. Quote, "These funds are very vital and very much needed for any repairs and restorations. We certainly hope within the next few years to completely stabilize the home and foundation," end quote, said Ravi Coltrane, a saxophonist and recording artist who lives in Brooklyn. He went on, "We are all on board with the mission of opening the house to the public and having it there in the community as something symbolic of what John Coltrane was able to do there, which is to be a beacon for the highest possibilities of creative achievement," end quote. The transfer of the home will be completed in partnership with the Friends of the John and Alice Coltrane Home, a nonprofit that manages the home the couple owned in Dix Hills, New York, on Long Island, according to a news release from the Action Fund. The Action Fund, in partnership with the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation, has pledged to spend $5.2 million to establish the Stewardship Initiative, which aims to protect spaces that have too often gone neglected and under-recognized. Said Brent Leggs, executive director of the Action Fund, quote, "Descendants and families have been doing this work for centuries on an informal basis. The initiative is about empowering descendants and families through historic preservation more formally. Our role is to give them the resources and technical expertise they need to protect and preserve the physical evidence of the past and share their profound stories with the American public," end quote. Only 2% of the 95,000 sites listed on the National Register of Historic Places center on the experiences of Black Americans, according to the Action Fund. The fund was founded in November 2017 to help address this disparity. With more than $95 million in philanthropic investment and more than 260 supported projects across the country, the Action Fund is the largest U.S. resource dedicated to the protection and preservation of African-American heritage sites. Recent efforts by the Action Fund have included protecting historic Black churches, documenting sites tied to Emmett Till's murder, and reevaluating the interpretation of landmarks connected to U.S. slavery. Quote, "It is exceptionally important that we grow, as we grow the U.S. historic preservation movement and advance values of equity and inclusion, that the future of this movement be sustained through the engagement and leadership of descendants and families," said Mr. Leggs. He went on, "They are critical to the future of our work to expand the American narrative and to build a true national identity that reflects America's diversity," end quote. End of article. Next article comes from thegriot.com and was posted March 18th. Originally ran in the Associated Press. Titled, "Sculpture Park Provides Unflinching Look at Faces and Lives of Enslaved Americans." Freedom Monument Sculpture Park in Montgomery, Alabama, is the Equal Justice Initiative's third site focused on America's history of slavery, racism, and discriminatory policing. It opens March 27th. I do not yet see a name of an author. I will announce it if I run across it. Dateline Montgomery, Alabama. Visitors to the Freedom Monument Sculpture Park wind a serpentine path past art pieces depicting the lives of enslaved people in America, and historic exhibits, including two cabins where the enslaved lived, before arriving at a towering monument. Stretching nearly four stories into the sky, the National Monument to Freedom honors the millions of people who endured the brutality of slavery. The monument is inscribed with 122,000 surnames that formerly enslaved people chose for themselves, as documented in the 1870 census, after being emancipated at the Civil War's end. The sculpture park is the third site created by the Equal Justice Initiative in Montgomery, Alabama, which is dedicated to taking an unflinching look at the country's history of slavery, racism, and discriminatory policing. The first two sites, the National Memorial for Peace and Justice, a memorial to people slain in racial terror killings, and the Legacy Museum, From Enslavement to Mass Incarceration, which opened in 2018. The sculpture park, which opens March 27th, weaves art installations, historic artifacts, and personal narratives to explore the history of slavery in America and honor the millions of people who endured its brutality. Brian Stevenson, the founder of Equal Justice Initiative, said after opening the first two sites that he felt there was more to do. Most plantation tourist attractions, he said, are centered around the lives of the family that did the enslaving. His goal was a place for visitors to have, quote, a really honest experience with the history of slavery, end quote. Oh, he goes on. I do see it as a truth-telling space, a place where we can confront parts of our history and paths that are not usually taught, end quote. But he also believes it is ultimately a hopeful place. Stevenson said, quote, if people found a way to create family and future, despite the horrors of that institution, then we can do something comparable in our day to create a future that is less burdened by these histories than I think we've been, end quote. The 17-acre site is nestled between the twisting banks of the muddy waters of the Alabama River and railroad tracks, the two transportation mechanisms used to bring people to the city's slave markets in the 1800s. Visitors will be able to arrive by boat, essentially tracing the same path taken to deliver the stolen and trafficked people. Still reading from the Griot. The Metz, the Harlem Renaissance, and Transatlantic Modernism honors America's Black Mecca. Pop culture critic Miles Marshall Lewis explores the through line from the Harlem Renaissance to hip-hop in the Metz new exhibition. This is written by Miles Marshall Lewis, posted March 6th. A Stone's Throw from Harlem. Pardon me, I'm not sure if I said this is still from thegriot.com. Forgive me. A Stone's Throw from Harlem on the stately campus of Columbia Journalism School, a two-day conference took place recently celebrating the legacy of hip-hop journalism, with panel discussions, recorded oral histories from former rap magazine editors, and stately portraits shot by Rog and B. Walker. Nuanced writing devoted to hip-hop culture finally got its flowers as a modern-day literary movement of sorts. When the time came for my own interview, I recalled being directly inspired by both the Black Arts Movement and the Harlem Renaissance, hoping the future would look back on us, having continued the tradition of documenting the Black creative expressions of our own time. Those thoughts came up again, walking by the 160 paintings, sculptures, and collectibles on view at the Metropolitan Museum of Art's latest exhibit, titled The Harlem Renaissance and Transatlantic Modernism. Seeing magazines like Fire, published in 1926 by literary luminaries like Zora Neale Hurston, County Cullen, and Langston Hughes, and The Crisis in glass display cases made me feel like part of a cultural continuum. Running until late July, the exhibition intends to, quote, explore the comprehensive and far-reaching ways in which Black artists portrayed everyday modern life in Harlem and nationwide in the early decades of the Great Migration. Toward that end, Met curators did the thing. It's a resounding success. As historical tomes like Sharifa Rhodes-Pitt's excellent Harlem is Nowhere have explained, New York City landlords originally meant the North Manhattan neighborhood of Harlem as a location for upper-class white residents in the late 19th century. Overdevelopment resulted in their desperation to fill empty buildings as best they could, with black folks, leading to white flight. By the 1920s, Harlem had swiftly turned into a major black mecca of the United States, attracting more than its fair share of painters, writers, poets, musicians, and intellects in one concentrated hood. Divided into sections like the Thinkers, parentheses. Said thinkers included W.E.B. Du Bois, Alain Locke, and Aaron Douglas. Nightlife, the new Negro artist abroad, parentheses, featuring film clips of Josephine Baker dancing the Charleston. And luminaries, spotlighting collaborations across the Pan-African diaspora. The Met exhibit covers a wide expanse of those Harlem Renaissance years, which last roughly from 1918 to 1937. Many of the exhibition's vividly painted portraits command immediate attention. Painter Laura Wheeler Waring's oil canvas of opera singer Marian Anderson in a floor-length red dress astounds as much in 2024 as it originally did in 1944. Parentheses, Waring's girl in a green cap is also pretty breathtaking. Charles Henry Alston's girl in a red dress captures its short-haired black female subject by mixing a modernist flatness with African aesthetics. The museum label references Fang Requillary busts to create a thing of beauty. The bold, thickly applied blues, yellows, and browns of artist William H. Johnson's Oil on Burlap, titled Women in Blue, come through as striking as a 4K animated movie. Original first editions of Zora Neale Hurston's Their Eyes Were Watching God and Alain Locke's The New Negro anthology opened the exhibit alongside arresting portraits of Locke and poet Langston Hughes, both by painter Winold Rice. By the time you reach the end of the Harlem Renaissance and transatlantic modernism, which concludes with Romare Bearden's wall-spanning collage piece titled The Block, all your smartphone photos of that era-defining art may not suffice. Expect brisk sales of the Met's $65 keepsake exhibition catalog. Once upon a time, in late 1969, the Metropolitan Museum of Art staged an exhibition titled Harlem on My Mind, Cultural Capital of Black America, 1900 to 1968, that notoriously failed to include any black contemporary artists of the period, leading to protest from the very community it purported to celebrate. Its corrective should not have taken 55 years, but it's here, and it's grand. Time will tell if, come the 2070s, the Met celebrates the centennial anniversary of hip-hop and its broad-ranging artistic contributions, no doubt including photographer Baron Claiborne's kingly portrait of Biggie Smalls and original editions of XXL, The Source, and The Vibe, etc., with the same vivacity. For now, the Harlem Renaissance and transatlantic modernism celebrates the foundation of an early black arts music. Pardon me, early black arts movement, with all the verve it deserves. There's a note at the bottom, and it's possible that a listener would have access to the podcast. It says, to further explore the impact of the Harlem Renaissance, tune into The Griot's upcoming podcast titled Harlem and Moscow, based on the true story of one of America's best-kept literary secrets. The audio drama reimagines the moment a group of Harlem Renaissance artists and activists traveled to Moscow in 1932. Harlem and Moscow, and its companion podcast, Harlem and Moscow Red Flags, will be available on the Griot Black Podcast Network or wherever you get podcasts on March 28th. And a note on the author is included Miles Marshall Lewis, is an author and Harlem-based cultural critic whose work has appeared in the New York Times Magazine, GQ, Rolling Stone, and many other outlets. Lewis is currently finishing a cultural biography of comedian Dave Chappelle. His follow-up to Promise That You Will Sing About Me, The Power and Poetry of Kendrick Lamar. Back to the New York Times. This is an opinion piece. Black families can now recover more of their lost histories. Written by Etta L. Fields Black. Dr. Fields Black is the author of Combee, Harriet Tubman, the Combahee River Raid, and Black Freedmen during the Civil War. Black Freedom during the Civil War. I don't see a date. Oh, February 29th, this was posted. In many ways, the overgrown cemetery on a South Carolina rice plantation, where my paternal ancestors are buried, is emblematic of Black history itself. On my first visit in 2013, I went in search of the Fields family graves. There I found many unmarked graves, some of them nothing more than sunken depressions, as far as the eye could see. A few had simple headstones. One marked grave had been broken wide open by a fallen tree limb and had filled with water. I was horrified to see my ancestors' skeletal remains floating at the top. After researching the history of peasant rice farmers in West Africa for over a decade, I had recently extended my research to enslaved laborers on Lowcountry South Carolina rice plantations. But I had not thought to research my own family's history. Seeing that open grave made me feel as though I had turned my back on my ancestors. I pledged then to find out who was buried in that cemetery and tell their story. African Americans searching for their family histories often have only small, irregular pieces of an enormous puzzle. Most of those pieces are missing because enslaved African Americans were not recorded by their first and last names. Until recently, identifying enslaved and formerly enslaved people who lived before that time was virtually impossible. To complicate matters, professional historians typically analyze and interpret plantation owners' records, which identify enslaved people as property and by first name only, and describe the violence that was done to them, how their labor was exploited, and their bodies abused. These records deny our ancestors' humanity. Because of these limitations, it had become accepted as fact among historians and genealogists that efforts to recover African American family histories reaching back to the time of slavery would hit a brick wall. Today, I'm excited to report, the brick wall, or at least a large part of it, has been dismantled. Projects to digitize enormous troves of once difficult-to-access records are giving African American families opportunities to recover more of our lost past and offering historians the potential to enrich and rewrite the history of slavery. When I embarked on my journey to research my father's family's history, all I had to go on was a list of names from the census that included that of Hector Fields, my great-great-great-grandfather, and his direct descendants. It wasn't much, but it was something. Most African Americans can trace their family back only a few generations. I knew I would need new tools to uncover the history of my enslaved ancestors. Fortunately, my mission aligned with the International African American Museum's Center for Family History in Charleston, South Carolina, one of the first genealogical centers focusing on African Americans. The center is open to both scholars and individuals who want to use the museum's resources to research their family history and the role African Americans have played in building and shaping the nation. Perhaps the most valuable resource of all is the United States Colored Troops Pension File Project, which is collecting the pension files of the African American men who served in Civil War regiments and making digitized records available to all, not just to scholars like me. Because these files have been so underused as an historical source, the potential for discovery here is exciting. Decades after the war, black veterans, along with their widows, dependents, and neighbors, told their stories of enslavement and freedom when they applied for pensions for their military service. Approximately 140,000 formerly enslaved men fought in the Civil War. Approximately 83,000 black Civil War veterans received pensions. To help in my search, the Center for Family History's researchers identified a Hector Fields, who had enlisted in the 2nd South Carolina Volunteers. They later found the file of a Jonas Fields, who served with black troops in the 128th Regiment. In Jonas's pension file, a woman by the name of Phoebe Washington testified that she had two brothers, Hector and Jonas Fields, who went after the war to work on rice plantations in the same area where the Fields family I knew lived. She gave the names of their parents, Anson and Judy, and the name of the family who held them in bondage in downtown Beaufort. With one pension file, I was able to fill in multiple gaps of my family tree. I found my great-great-great-great-grandparents, Hector Fields' siblings, and the location where most of my paternal grandfather's family had been enslaved. Jonas Fields' pension file also confirmed that I am a direct descendant of the same Hector Fields who fought in the famous Combahee River Raid in 1863, when Harriet Tubman, who was working as a spy for the United States Army, provided key intelligence in the daring expedition to rescue some 700 people from bondage on 7 South Carolina rice plantations. My cousins and I were so proud, we were also profoundly sorry that our Fields family patriarch, who had pointed me to the plantation cemetery, did not live long enough to learn of this important history. Eventually, I collaborated with the International African American Museum to widen my research beyond my own family and help identify hundreds of the 756 enslaved people who liberated themselves in the Combahee Raid, then trace their lives backward into enslavement and forward into freedom. It may sound difficult, but it is easier than you think for African Americans who are not professional researchers or scholars to break down the brick walls in their own family histories. Use genealogical search engines like Ancestry.com or FamilySearch to identify ancestors who have Civil War pension files. Then order copies from the National Archives or view them on the museum's Center for Family History website, parentheses, for South Carolina regiments. If you are fortunate enough to obtain a file in which other soldiers testify, you can deepen your research by requesting these soldiers' pension files too. The testimony of your ancestor's widow, comrades and neighbors in another soldier's pension file may hold additional keys to your family's history. African American veterans approved for Civil War pensions could have thousands of descendants, so millions of African Americans could recover their family's history using these recently digitized records. I hope that the files will inspire and energize historians to create tools and methods of recovering our ancestors' names, our ancestors' names, voices, and stories. This knowledge could have profound effects on what Americans know about slavery and how we grapple with its legacy. My cousins and I have come together to fix the grave in the cemetery that had been damaged and to identify and mark one of the Fields family's unmarked graves. There are still pieces missing from my family's puzzle, but finding Hector Fields was the beginning. And that brings me to the end of our time for this week. Thank you so much for joining us for the Black Experience Hour.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.